JP, great to have you on the show. And I wanted to start with, it's good to have you here, Jay. And I want to start with, we've been having a bit of a theme here about celebrity sightings because, you know, Brad Trey Living had a chance to get close to Barack Obama, and Brian Burke had a chance to meet with former President George Bush as well. Anthony Stewart hung out with The Weeknd, and I met Mark Wahlberg and hung out with him a little bit. What about you? You spent a lot of time in L.A. I'm sure you have some good celebrity sightings in your day.
Okay, I guess you can choose between Tom Cruise or Vladimir Putin. Sorry about that cell phone in Toronto here.
Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, you have to choose between those two.
All right, there's got to be a
Putin. I'd rather hear about Tom Cruise.
Well, okay, I want to hear about... Wow, so there's some stories there. You got a story for us.
No, when we brought our hockey division over to CAA, we did it along with the baseball and our football division. We had our sort of first meeting at CAA, and we're sitting in a sort of small going about our plans for starting a new sports division with all three of them. And as the sort of our new director was explaining things, the lights sort of went up. I was walking down the steps behind us with a couple of bugglefish in a bag. And you know the analogy. So it was Tom Cruise, and he was welcoming us to CAA, and I guess he was doing his best Jerry Maguire impersonation for us. So that was quite funny, and he spent the meeting with us. So that was an interesting connection.
He's a little wee guy, eh?
What's that?
He's a little wee guy, eh?
Yeah, I was really, really shocked. Yeah, like 5'5", maybe? 5'5", 5'6".
You know, I met Schwarzenegger came to our cup party, and he's no more than 5'9 or 5'10". Like, I could eat peanuts off his head.
Yeah, really?
When we do our training camp in the summertime with our young players, he's always, like, working out at the gym there. And, yeah, you're right. He's, like, he's very small. They say all the players are small with big heads.
Well, Schwarzenegger's shoulders were a little wider than mine, but he was shorter than I was.
Wow. Sylvester Stallone, same thing, right?
Yep.
Oh, that's funny. So Jay, listen, you've created you know, a bit of an agent empire with CAA, some of the biggest names in the game. You know, here in Toronto, you got Riley and Tavares as a couple of your key clients. Take us through where you started out as in the legal profession to the evolution of where you are now.
Well, Brian will remember I was hired. I was a young labor lawyer in Toronto, and the Players Association was gearing up to become a bigger entity and to hire people. And I came in to the Players Association right around the time of the lockout in the 90s, and immediately started working with actually Brian and Dave Nonis on the other side on quite a few different cases. And then probably after about 4 years there, I had worked with a lot of the agents in the business and decided to move out. And Mike Barnett sort of the one day after starting on my way at IMG.
JP, what's your advice to parents right now that are in Toronto who are obviously listening right now that... you know, there's some that are being approached at, you know, 13, 14, 15 years old. When's the right time to get an agent, and what should they be asking, and what should they be doing when trying to choose the right agent for them?
You know, I think the whole age of selecting an agent has gotten completely out of control, and I'm one of the people talking to the Players Association about perhaps putting in a rule that we have in Sweden where you're allowed to make contact until the 16th or down this birth year. So I think 15 is the youngest. I think decisions have to be made at 15, but I think anything below 15 is completely unnecessary, and I think we have to try and stop that and just let players develop.
And we, you know what, we were talking about Connor Bedard, who's just given exceptional status. He's a 15-year-old out in British Columbia. I'm sure you've been made aware of what he potentially could become. How do you enforce that? Because there's always going to be people who will go around, and if it's not the agent specifically going and talking to the young player, it's going to be a friend of the agent or an associate. And how would you enforce that? Because it does seem right that you shouldn't have 12 and 13-year-olds getting approached by agencies, but you do have it happen.
Well, we have 10 years of it in Sweden now, and I think the best enforcers of the rules are the other agents who didn't get the players. They're going to let you know what happened. They're going to let you know how the contact made and who through the process. And there has been over there where there's even fines and suspension. So, no, you have to take it. You have to take it seriously.
Berkey.
Yeah, it's a little different. Obviously, it's really matured because it was a long time ago that I represented players, but I did my first player contract, I think, in 1983. I graduated from law school in 81, and I think I worked on my first two contracts for Mike Buzniak and Frank Baith in 1983, and then it really took off. But all the guys I got were referrals. They were all referred to me. So, like, I got Brett Hull's mom called me and asked me if I'd represent him, and people were calling me and asked me if I represent them. So I didn't get into the recruiting, and I didn't get into certainly not kids. No one was talking to 15-year-old kids back then, but it's very different. Back then, there was like a handful of guys that had probably 80% of the players. You know, Art Kaminsky, Norm Kaplan, Gus Bedali, that group. And they really had a lock on the business. It was really hard to get clients. So I got lucky. The first two guys that I represented played with me in the American League. And it just went from there. And then I picked up Kevin Dineen and Brett Hull and Joel Otto and ended up having like 30 guys in the show by the time I got out in 1987. So very different now. Parents ask me all the time. I say, you don't need an agent. You don't technically need an agent until you've got a decision to make on playing somewhere. And that's not till 16, in my view.
What would be your advice, though, to young aspiring agents? Because that's another part of the equation. I'm sure you have a lot of young guys who are getting into law and young women who say, I'd love to do what you're doing. What do you tell them?
Well, you got to do it the right way. You have to build your business the right way, and you have to look at the leaders in the business and see who's the best model for you and try to build your business the right way. And if you don't want to build it the right way, then it's a very tough business to survive in because – you know, there's some very quality groups there at the top of the chain, as Brian knows.
What's the right way? Give us a bit more depth on that.
Well, it starts with initial contact, like what you're doing with the player, the kind of advice you're giving them, looking at every single option. I mean, what you're mostly doing with a 15-year-old is making very big decisions about their path in life and taking a look at who they are. Like there's some kids that are really decent students that should really look at the path of going towards the NCAA. So that's something that you'll have to start looking at. Okay, well, what are they going to do at age 16, 17, 18? Because, you know, you don't really play in the NCAA until 18, 19, 20. So, or if it's the OHL, if it's a young player who's driving towards the OHL, like, should they go at 16? Do they need another year of development? Should they actually be patient and wait? So there's a lot of decisions about timing and path that you have to go through.
I remember, JP, there when I worked at the league, I went down and met with the college coaches, and they were really upset that we were taking guys out of school. So, and you know, you take a guy out after his second year and say, well, we don't take a guy out unless we're pretty sure he's going to play within 12 months. Otherwise, we'd just as well leave him there. He doesn't count as a contract. We don't have to worry about him. We're only allowed 50 contracts, so we really kind of have the same interest as you. But once a guy has maxed out his ability at that level, where there's nothing more he can accomplish, it's time to go. And I said, and by the way, you guys can complain all you want about us taking a guy after his second year, but that guy's likely to be 21 now and not 20, because they park these guys in the USHL for a year or even 2 years. Some guys get scholarship commitments at 16, but they got to play till they're 20 in the USHL.
And I think it's evolved now. I think they actually realize that they have two tracks of players. They have these stars that come in at 18 and sometimes 19, who they know they're probably only going to keep for 2 years, maybe if they're lucky three, but mostly two. And then they have the other players, like you said, who they want to they want to put them out in Penticton in the BCHL, or they want to put them in the USHL till they're probably about 20. And a lot of them play from age 20 to 24, so it's definitely an older, you know, older man's league compared to the OHL.
Yeah, I remember when I was a freshman at Providence College, I was 18, and so were all the other freshmen. And I think Matt Gilroy, when he won the Hobey Baker, was 25. So it's totally different from when I played. Every freshman in a room was a true freshman, was an 18-year-old. And that's just not the case anymore. Yeah. There might be one.
And Jay,
no,
you have an
focus on development and path, and the NCAA is an older league.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, you have an extensive roster of NHL clients. What kind of questions have the players been asking you? What kind of advice have you had to give them during this work stoppage that's very unexpected?
I think the hardest thing to tell them is to slow down. You don't need to skate tomorrow. A lot of these guys have not gone. Some of the younger players literally haven't gone a week in their lives without skating. So this is a little bit of a shock to their system that they can't get to a hockey rink. They can train at home. So, I mean, the hardest thing is, sorry, guys, like, we all got to just sit down and relax here and wait this thing out for a while. And I think it's hard for all of us right now to just, you know, stay at home and not do things.
With your European clients, did you have to help with the logistics? Because, you know, the mandate was given by Commissioner Bettman a little more than a week ago that you don't have to stay in your home city, your city of where you play. If you want to go back to Sweden, to Finland, to the Czech Republic, go about that. Did you get involved at all to help the logistics there?
We did. I mean, actually, we had a real conflict because even though that mandate came out, a lot of the teams didn't want the players to leave, and Brian understands that as a manager. You always feel like, I want to keep them close by, and this thing could start back up. But in this instance, I really did not feel that we were looking at weeks. I felt that we were looking at months, and I pretty much got most of my Swedes. If they wanted to go home, if they were Swede or Russian or Finn or Czech, they went home. So we got involved in, I think, close to 30 players getting sent back to Europe over 3 or 4 days.
And Jay, you and Berkey collaborated, back in the day, the Sedins. You were the agent for the Sedins. Berkey, obviously, from what he told me, he was instrumental in getting the Sedins together in Vancouver. I'm not sure if that's true or not. I mean, what was it like? What was it like, you guys working through that to pull off one of the great moves in NHL draft history, really?
Oh, Brian definitely had to take the lead because he had to make these trades that were very, very difficult trades. Our job, I spent a couple months trying to find a team that would do this. And, Brian will know I have a good relationship with Dave Nonis, and it started with us talking about, look, we want to do this. Like, we're definitely going to have these two young clients play together. And part of that was telling other teams that if they're not together, one of them's going to go play junior and become a free agent in 2 years. That was the play at the time, that one player could play out, that come over here from Sweden and play junior hockey and be a free agent and join his brother in 2 years. So that was the leverage that we were using to get other teams to back off. So Brian got the trades, but I had to do a lot of not pleasant calls with other teams that were trying to draft one of the other Sedins.
Well, you know what's interesting, or at least I think it's interesting, was, and you guys were helpful, you and Michael Barnett were definitely helpful in getting Tampa to trade the first pick overall down, because you made it clear to Rick Dudley, because I remember he called me, we were screaming at each other on the phone. He said, you sent your trained donkeys up here to threaten me? He says, how dare you? I said, I didn't send anyone up there. So anyway, but again, I've told the story. I wasn't even sold on this whole thing until I saw him in the World Championships that year. That's where I got religion.
Yeah, I was at that World Championships, and I knew from that World Championships, Rick Dudley had just moved from Ottawa to Tampa Bay, so everyone had told me sort of through the Ottawa circuit that he had Daniel Sedin at the time rated number one. So I think we all were operating under the assumption that at that time that Daniel was going to be the number one pick.
Yeah, for sure, and that's what I tell people when people ask me about it, how smart I was. I said, well, I wasn't all that smart. I didn't take them in the right sequence because, as it turns out, Hank was actually a better pro than Danny. They're both joys, and I know Danny doesn't like hearing this, but we found out that Hank could play with anybody, but Danny could only play with Hank. And so I took them in the wrong order, and then that's why they were 22 and 33. They wanted high numbers. You remember this, JP? And I said, no high numbers on my team, so take 22 and 33. And now no one will ever wear those numbers again.
Yeah, those numbers. I also remember at the time they were supposed to go 1-2, but somehow you made a switch at the very last second to make them go 2-3 so that I would get lower bonuses in the contract.
Yeah, it worked, too. You guys screwed me though, because we had said, okay, what, I said, if I can do this, what are you looking at for bonuses? And you guys gave me a, said, this is what we're looking for. And then I made the deal and it came back a little different, not too much, but it screwed me a little bit.
Well, unfortunately for you, Patrick Stefflin took his number one and got a big deal, so we had to get the same or close to it.
What do you guys remember, JP, you and Berkey? Obviously, you had to work against one another as an agent, as a GM. What do you remember having to sit there in the negotiation room with a Brian Burke?
No, I mean, as Brian knows, there's different styles of negotiation, and you know, it can get contentious sometimes near the very end, but you're generally working towards a goal, and every side has to give, and there has to be a lot of communication, so there's more than just the two of us butting heads. And, you know, oftentimes in Brian's days in Vancouver, like, I would start with David, and he and I would go at it, and then sometimes at the time, Mike Barnett would talk to Brian, and, you know, I was the number two to Mike at that time, so it's, you know, it's a process. Like, it's sometimes 30, 40 calls, and it can stretch over months, or sometimes it can all happen in 48 hours.
Yeah, and that, JP, you bring up a good point. See, I never thought, when I worked for Pat as the assistant manager, I never thought that was a good use of his time to make 40 phone calls. So I did all the player contracts, every single one except for the two Russians, Larionov and Krutov. And when I got to Toronto, my first year in Vancouver, I think I did all the contracts. Then Dave Nonis did them all. So he did most of the Sedins. I had very little to do with that other than, like you say, jump in and curse and yell once in a while. But we had, if you recall, we had done a lot of the work on these contracts before we did the deal. I said, look, I'm not doing this. I'm not stepping off the face of the known earth and then getting a demand that doesn't make sense. If I can pull this off, what are we looking at? So we had some idea what we were looking at beforehand. And you guys, like I say, you screwed me a little at the end, but that's okay. It worked out okay.
It was rough.
It did. It worked out perfectly well. The Sedins, both numbers retired, and soon enough, both will be in the National the Hockey Hall of Fame as well. So it did work out, that's for sure.
All you need to do, Brian, I think Brian's done it, but all you need to do is look at that actual draft year. And that was a minefield draft. I think the Sedins together have almost more games than the entire rest of the round, except if you take maybe Martin Havlat or Tim Connolly out of the mix. That was not a great draft. So he definitely got, you know, the two best players.